Do you remember several months ago that incredible UFO case over Stephenville, Texas? Linda Moulton Howe has some more information for us when we come right back on Coast to Coast AM. This Stephenville, Texas UFO case, Linda, continues to be one of the strangest stories I've ever heard.
And increasing in strength of hard data.
Yes.
You know, back in early January to February, it's now a little bit more than a half a year, there were a series of unidentified aerial lights and strange craft, and they were reported by dozens of eyewitnesses in the Stephenville, Dublin, and Selden region, which is southwest of Dallas-Fort Worth, Texas, about 3 hours by car. And one especially active date, even though this went on from at least the 1st of January till about February 13th, January 8th stood out, starting around 6 p.m. Central Time, with the first three eyewitnesses sitting on a hill in Selden, southeast of Stephenville and straight west of Dublin. And one of those eyewitnesses was Steve Allen, who is a pilot and a businessman, and he's a longtime resident of nearby Glenrose. And he's accustomed to watching civilian and military air traffic, but he told me that he had never seen anything like the aerial display on January 8th. And you all listening can see sketches by Steve Allen along with maps, graphics, and radar data at my news website, www.earthfiles.com, in my reports that are up there tonight about this radar and the discoveries. And what happened in Selden, the details are there at Earth Files, and what we're going to focus on tonight are the radar data. And the fact that it's very interesting that Steve said that two F-16 jets came roaring toward the lights in front of him and his two colleagues with afterburners on high and gave chase. And there were several other UFO eyewitness reports that night until at least 8 p.m. Central, and they were reported by Angela Joyner when she worked for the Stephenville Empire Tribune, and all of this news quickly spread to TV networks and beyond to international headlines. Well, one man in Littleton, Colorado, was following all of this Stephenville, Texas phenomena. He's Glenn Schultz, a semi-retired radar specialist. Glenn received a BS degree in electrical engineering from Washington University in St. Louis, Missouri, in 1952.
Great university. Lynn.
It is. And then Glenn was drafted into the U.S. Army from September 1952 to 1954, and he was assigned to assist in the test and evaluation of the chain radar network at the White Sands Missile Range in New Mexico. A decade later, from 1965 to 71, he worked at Cape Canaveral for the NASA Apollo program, in which he produced reentry instrumentation records. As Apollo closed down, Glenn went to work for Martin Marietta in Littleton, Colorado, in support of Skylab, the first space station the United States launched into orbit from 73 to 79. And Glenn supported the tape recording of key instrumentation of the data that Skylab was sending back in sensors for science reports about the studies of the sun and effects of microgravity. Well, Glenn knows that on January 8, 2008, the Federal Aviation Administration's radar beacons, designed to help air traffic controllers reduce air congestion around airports, they would have received whatever transponder beacon signals were sent from normal civilian and military aircraft in the greater Dallas-Fort Worth and Stephenville region. And Glenn also knew that FAA radar tapes can be erased and reused within 14 days. So if he was going to get any usable data, it was urgent that he file a Freedom of Information Act request immediately after what he heard January 8th was a big night. Glenn mailed his FOIA request on January 16, 2008, for data from the five air route traffic control center antennas that were within 250 nautical miles of Stephenville. And he received back 2.5 million radar data returns.
Two and a half million.
Yeah. Now, to help analyze all this data and compare it to the many January 8, 2008 eyewitness accounts of this strange aerial phenomenon, MUFON Research Director Robert Powell joined in the effort. Robert, 54, received a B.S. in chemistry from Southeastern Oklahoma State University in 1976. He worked in the semiconductor industry for almost 30 years. Both men wanted to know if the FAA radar data would produce what are called skin paint tracks of unknown objects, and an unknown would not be using transponders that beep. So by definition, in this research, an unknown object, it's giving out a skin paint on radar, but it is not beeping like all of the civilian and most of the military traffic. If there were unknowns, then Robert Powell wanted to study their latitude and longitude data to calculate speeds, directions, and timelines to compare them with all these eyewitness accounts. And after hundreds of research hours, this month of July, Glenn Schultz and Robert Powell released their formal report through MUFON, the Mutual UFO Network, and it confirms they did find FAA radar unknowns that do not match up to any known civilian or military aircraft between 4 and 8 p.m. on January 8, 2008, the time period for which they asked in their FOIA request. Now, one unknown traveled for nearly an hour very slowly on a straight track toward the President George W. Bush Ranch in Crawford, Texas, east of Stephenville. And recently, I talked with Glenn and Robert about their radar research, that straight-line unknown object, and what provoked Glenn to file his FOIA request so rapidly back in January 2008.
The first thing that drove me in that direction was Major Carl Lewis at the Carswell Air Force Base installation saying within 2 days that they had no airplanes in the air. And I said, wait a minute, this sounds like Roswell all over again. Here we have people on the ground saying they're seeing all this activity, and the Air Force is saying, oh, we didn't have anything in the air. So I said, if there's anything in the air, the FAA radar is going to show it. And so I went out and I FOIA'd on two different FAA facilities, the Air Route Traffic Control Center in Fort Worth, which is responsible for all of Texas plus adjoining states with about 16 different rotating antennas. And I sent in a second standalone FOIA to the Dallas-Fort Worth TRACON staff. These are the people that are right at the DFW runways controlling the landings and the takeoffs of the airplane.
You received data then from how many radar towers?
I received data from 5 completely different FAA antenna towers, and that totaled up to over 2.5 million returns. I had also requested 5 additional and different antenna data, which I did not get.
Do you understand why you didn't get any of that data?
I can tell you what they told me. They told me that my TRACON request had arrived too late at their technical staff and that the data was no longer available. They did not say the data had been recorded over. They said the data is no longer available, which made me a little unhappy because both of my FOIAs, the one that succeeded from the center, which got me 2.5 million data returns, and the second one, which got me nothing, both went out in the same envelope of transmittal on the same date, 8 days after the event. So 2 different, completely standalone FOIAs. One succeeded, one didn't.
Is it correct that you acted so quickly because you knew that in many cases, radar tapes would be erased and reused, and you wanted to act before the 14 days were up?
Exactly.
Describe when you first realized that you were dealing with unknowns.
Probably 2 to 3 months into the exercise, it was a very difficult task, not only because of the volume of returns we had, but the fact that we had an equal number of beacon returns that were being received from cooperative airplanes in the air that had beacons, that when they got scanned from the ground, the beacon went back and said, here I am, here's my 4-digit PIN number.
And this is what comes from the transponders in civilian and military planes?
Yes, the transponder is what answers the sweeping antenna from the ground, and it says, here I am, I want to be identified. Here's my altitude. Here's my code number. Don't lose track of me, guys. I'm cooperating with you. That's called a secondary or a transponder beacon return. A half of our returns were of that type. The other half of the returns were uncooperative, unbeaconed targets, which we got skin paint returns from, but no help, no beacons, no PIN numbers, no altitudes. So I had a real task of trying to sift through all of this to try and see where are there unknowns over Stephenville that I should zero in on. And that took me about 2.5 months.
What was the first thing that excited you?
The fact that the unknowns were at the right time of day. They were in the right latitude and longitude. And for over an hour, we got almost 200 returns from an unknown, unbeaconed, unidentified device, all in a straight line ground track headed to the southeast over Stephenville.
Glenn Schultz's colleague in the FAA radar analysis is 54-year-old Robert Powell, a chemist retired from the semiconductor industry. Robert lives in Austin, Texas, and is currently director of research for the Mutual UFO Network. Robert studied the FAA radar data to see if he could match any of it to eyewitness descriptions and timelines. Between 6:15 p.m. and 6:51 p.m., he found several eyewitnesses, in addition to Steve Allen and his friends, that correlated with unknowns. And like Glenn, Robert was surprised by the unknown object that traveled from south of Dublin in a straight line.
And this object we actually track on radar for over an hour. And this is the one that, if you continue tracking it, by 8 o'clock, it is within 10 miles of the Crawford Ranch.
So that's only 25 minutes after the Steve Allen and his colleague's sighting in Selden.
Yes, that's approximately 25 minutes after his sighting. The only thing I can say is that the object I tracked for an hour is on a straight line course. Now, it disappears off radar occasionally during that 1 hour period, but its course is always constant. The average speed is around 44 to 49 miles per hour. That's very slow. Now, there is one time on radar where the object clocking it between every 10-second radar sweep. At one point in time, it's at 532 miles an hour, and 10 seconds later, it's at 49 miles an hour. The only one that might be able to do that in a 10-second time frame would be either a Harrier-type jet, or I believe the new F-35s have Harrier-type jet capabilities. So the problem would be to maintain a slow speed for over an hour. I would think they would run out of fuel, but I'm not an expert on those type of aircraft.
Any aircraft that is low and traveling at 49 miles an hour, you would assume would make quite a bit of noise that would have been heard by everyone. And yet, everyone's report is that everything they saw was completely silent.
Right. We only have one witness, and that was the lady who was near Alexander. When she saw it, she heard nothing.
What about tracks going to the Crawford Ranch?
Our main thought was there's an object moving in that direction. What would be the reaction of the military aircraft? And, of course, we looked at that, and we didn't see any reaction from them. So that was probably the most surprising part to us. Whether this object is military aircraft, civilian aircraft, or whatever it is, it just seems strange that they would not react. So that either indicates they already know what it is, and they're not concerned, or they have not seen it on the F-16's radar.
In a time of war in which national security from any kind of terrorist attacks is this administration's stated highest priority, how could there be these unknowns flying around in the air from 6:15 p.m. to 8 p.m. when your data ends without military response, especially at the Crawford Bush compound?
That's a very good question, one which I don't have an answer to. In our report, we believe there's probably an AWACS aircraft in the area during this entire time frame. We found an object that maintained an altitude of about 41,000 feet, which is higher than most of your civilian aircraft fly. It was there for the entire time we have our radar data, and it's flying figure eights over the area, going as far north as North Texas to as far south as north of the Austin area. And those aircraft have the capability of seeing down with radar for 250 miles. Those type of aircraft are used whenever they're trying to control I mean, they're like a flying headquarters, basically.
Your implication is, if it's a flying headquarters, that somebody might have had knowledge of something in that Stephenville Crawford area that needed to be observed during that period of 4 to 8 p.m. on January 8, 2008?
What I can say is I would think that if that was an AY, they would have seen all objects in that area. I think there's sufficient data here between radar and the witness accounts to establish enough likelihood that we have unknown objects, that the government should look at this and provide an answer to the public.
And why doesn't our Congress, why does no one in what is considered a position of public authority pay serious attention to this data and call Glenn and call Robert and say, we want information, we want to know what is happening? Why were there no military jets responding in an area where the President of the United States has a compound? And Glenn told me that it has been the lack of communication by people who are in authority of some kind that you would think would follow up with them on this, and they have not. And you know, silence often means the people in authority have a lot more knowledge and they are keeping their mouths shut because there's a policy of denial.
Exactly.
In the interest of national security. And I think that it is one of the most significant discoveries in all of this research is what appears to be an airborne early warning and control. That's what an AWAC is, at 41,000 feet during that entire 4 to 8 p.m. time period that they had the radar data, doing figure eights from northern Texas up in the Panhandle down to northern Austin and covering that area at 41,000 feet. And when you go and do some research about what do we have in the AWAC inventory, there is a what is called the U.S. Air Force E-3 Sentry. And this is a plane that is used to guard the air. And with its rotating radar, which is the mushroom that you see in the photographs, it can reach hundreds of miles into the air for what they're looking for is enemy aircraft. And if an enemy plane is detected, friendly fighter planes will be guided toward the enemies by the radar operators that are in this AWAC. Well, it was up there. There were all of these citizens on January 8th who were reporting to authorities there. Glenn and Robert have radar unknowns now, skin paints, that match a lot of those eyewitnesses. And yet that one peculiar object going from 500 and some miles an hour down to 47 to 49 miles an hour on a straight line for a little over an hour to the Crawford compound, the Bush compound.
Mm-hmm.
No jets. What? Why? What in the world does it mean? That's what we would all like answers to, because when it comes to this strange high strangeness of what has to be called unidentified flying objects that were definitely all over the Stephenville region, maybe somebody in that AWAC at 41,000 feet either knew something was up or they were monitoring.
When we come right back, Linda will talk in depth about that magnetic type rock that was found near Roswell, New Mexico. You remember that story we talked about? Well, she's done an in-depth investigation into this very strange carved rock. Back in a moment with Linda Moulton Howe on Coast to Coast AM. Neat email from a StringLink member this morning. He said, George, I woke up in the morning. The entire show was there on my iPod, ready to listen. That's just one of the benefits when you pick up StreamLink for just pennies a day. Just go to coasttocoastam.com and read all about it. Linda, we talked about this incredible rock that had this carving in it a couple weeks ago. Truly a remarkable story. So I'm glad that you have covered this now in depth.
Yeah, I even went down there and held it in my hand and all of this testing and talked with Robert Ridge and scientists. And it goes back almost 4 years ago now. It was September 4th, 2004. And Robert Ridge is a self-employed auto shop owner. He's lived in Roswell all of his life, and he likes to hunt.
Mm-hmm.
And he decided to go bow and arrow hunting for deer in what is called the Cedar Hill region near Capitan Mountain. It's well known to deer hunters there. And it's about 17 miles southeast of the alleged UFO crash of a wedge-shaped aerial vehicle between Corona and Roswell, now some 61 years ago in the July 4th to July 6th, 1947 period. And Robert Ridge has gone into the Cedar Hill area many times. He's about 50 years old now. So this was something he has done many times. And he was following hoof tracks on a trail, thinking that they were deer. And his head was down as he's intently watching the tracks in front of him. That's what he's staring at. When a brownish red rock caught his attention only about 12 feet away.
I've got my head down, you know, looking at the tracks, and I look over and notice this rock. And I could kind of see a design on it, you know, from probably maybe 10 or 12 feet from me. But I didn't pick it up right then. I went ahead with what I was doing. Turns out that what I was tracking was actually goats. When I found that out, I thought, well, maybe I should go pick up that rock. So I went back and found it. That was probably about 2 o'clock in the afternoon on September 4th of 04.
When you picked up the rock, what was your first reaction?
Just curiosity. I was kind of taken back by the design and was just really kind of awestruck by it. It was quite dirty. I got it back to the truck and brushed it off and was just started examining it, you know, in the sunlight. And the first thought that came to my mind was that it looked like it had been done by the finger of God. That was my first impression of it because I couldn't understand how anybody else could have done it.
The fact that that pattern seems to be three-dimensionally lifted up from the surface of this hard rock is extraordinary.
Yes, it's been taken away. You know, everything around it has been taken away to expose that up out of it. And it has some beveling. Instead of just a 90-degree cut, you know, down, some of the circles have like a 90-degree backside where it's straight up and straight down. And then the front of the circle comes like down to a 45.
Right. And it looks sculpted.
We had a sculptor look at it. She had no idea how it could be sculpted or reproduced herself. So it's pretty much a question mark right now. The first time we ever put a magnet to it, I saw that it was reactive to the magnet.
In what way?
It spins. The rock will spin when you hold a magnet over the top of it, like over one circle, it spins counterclockwise. And then if you hold the magnet over the other side of the other circle, it spins counterclockwise.
You found this rock on September 4th, 2004, in the afternoon while you were bow hunting deer.
Correct.
And we have not learned about this until 2008, July. So what held you back over those 4 years?
Well, I knew that it was something special. And I kept it to myself basically for personal reasons. Because I fell in love, I guess you could say, with it. And I didn't really want to share it with people. I'm a pretty private person. I was trying to prepare myself and get all my ducks in a row for what might happen when I did finally show it to the public, you know.
Mm-hmm.
I didn't want people to think that I was in it for monetary gain. That's basically why I've waited this long.
What do you say to people who say, oh, this must be a hoax? This is something that somebody has planted for publicity because it looks like the 1996 crop formation?
Well, I've had that already. I just say to them that, unfortunately, I was by myself that day when I found it, but it'd be for them to prove that it's a hoax because we're trying to prove that it's not. We haven't been able to find anybody who could say they could make something like that. And it would be such a fluke, you know, for somebody to plant it and hope that somebody finds it out there in the middle of nowhere. If you planted something like that, it might be 100 years before somebody found it.
If a crop formation was photographed and was available at cropcircleconnector.com to see in August of 1996, why couldn't somebody have copied that and put it on a stone and deposited it in Cedar Hill, New Mexico in 2004?
Well, anything's possible, but very, very improbable as far as we know up to date.
The Cedar Hill and that deer hunting area, how many people in a year might visit there?
Mostly herds go in there. There's really not a whole lot to see and do in there unless you're hunting. It's probably 40 miles from Roswell.
If this rock had been, let's say, under bushes or even slightly under the dirt from 60 years ago, is there anything about that area that would explain why it might suddenly have been exposed in 2004?
It's a sandy area. You know how the wind blows out here. The sand shifts and, you know, covers and uncovers things on a regular basis.
Mm-hmm. Have you ever, in your 50 years, had any interaction with anything that was a disc-shaped craft?
Yes.
Can you talk about that?
Yeah. It was November 5th of 1995, 4:30 in the morning. I remember it like it was yesterday. We were headed out east of town, and that morning was a harvest moon. And it was the most beautiful moonset that I probably ever saw in my life. There's a little valley east of town here, and you have to climb a hill before you can drop off into the valley. And we had just gone over the hill into the valley, into the darkness. And as soon as we topped over the hill, this is about probably 10 miles out of town, from the north, which would be to our left, came a silver object over into the valley with us, kind of. And it was moving at a super high rate of speed. And it was leaving a vapor trail behind it. This vapor trail was probably bigger than the craft itself. Long after the craft was gone, this vapor trail hung in that valley. And it was this brilliant orange color because the moon was still shining on it. And the vapor trail, it was sparkling, like little firecrackers going off in it, like phosphorus burning or something in the vapor trail. It was spectacular. It was something to see. The craft was more of a triangle shape, though.
Okay, when you say triangle, can you describe it in more detail?
Triangle probably wouldn't be good. It was more of a, say, a half diamond type shape. And I believe if the moon hadn't been like it was that morning, that everything would have been silver and white. The vapor trail would have been white and the craft would have been silver. But with this harvest moonshine on it, it was all a brilliant orange color.
Okay. And half of a diamond is triangle shaped. The government documents say the objects were not disc-shaped that came down in Roswell, east of Alamogordo, and at White Sands. They were wedge-shaped.
That would be this, yes. That would be the word I would be looking for.
A piece of pie shape.
Yeah, yeah.
Robert Ridge took his special rock to a Portales, New Mexico lab back in 2004 for X-ray spectroscopy analysis. I called that lab and learned that all the original test results have been later lost in a computer hard disk crash. So on Tuesday, July 15th, 2008, I drove to Portales to meet Robert Ridge, who had his mysterious carved rock. We went to the Physical Sciences Department of Eastern New Mexico University. The chair of that department is geology professor James Constantopoulos, Ph.D., who has taught at ENMU for nearly 20 years. The rock is a dark chocolate color with a touch of red and has a satin smooth finish. It's a bit heart-shaped and only about 2 inches by 1.5 inches. One end is twice as thick as the other. The thickest part is where one of the circle and crescent patterns are, which extend down to another crescent and circle at the thinnest part of the rock. The pattern is very refined with beveled edges and seems to rise more than an eighth of an inch up from the surface of the rock. And most incredibly, the pattern is a match to the extraordinary August 2, 1996 crop formation at Lyttington Castle in Wiltshire, England. That was also the same pattern of two circles and two crescent moons, which has always been on the list of crop formations without any signs of man-made or mechanical damage. Professor Constantopoulos closely examined the front and back of the rock under his binocular optical microscope, watched his pencil magnet click to the side of the rock, which indicated the presence of magnetite, and confirmed with X-ray fluoroscopy that the rock is largely iron and silicon. Robert Ridge placed his own auto shop magnet over one crescent and circle, and the rock turned clockwise. He moved his magnet to the other crescent and circle, and the rock turned counterclockwise. You can see videotape that I took in the lab of the rock turning in these opposite positions at my news website, earthfiles.com. At the top of the headline page is a hot link to this report that includes the video. Crop formations are also famous for having clockwise and counterclockwise lays of the plants. And I asked Professor Constantopoulos if whoever or whatever made the rock pattern might have intended that one crescent circle turn clockwise and the other turn counterclockwise.
I think it was just selective positioning of the magnet and due to irregularities in the shape of the sample.
And have you seen a variation in clockwise and counterclockwise rotation in other magnetite rocks based only on the shape of the rock?
No, because it's not really something we do. As a geologist, we're only concerned with, is it magnetic or not? And is it strongly magnetic, suggestive of magnetite, or is it weakly magnetic and suggestive of one of the other iron and titanium-bearing minerals? And also to look at the carving itself in detail, to look for any evidence of tool marks or mechanical work on the sample itself.
Or even heating from something like a laser?
Yes, exactly. And it didn't appear to have been formed by a laser. It's too perfect to have been done by hand, and the material is too hard. Really doesn't lend itself well to hand working. But I could see someone with machining experience could possibly produce a pattern like this.
But you didn't find any evidence of how it was made?
No, I did not.
What was your overall impression of this pattern in something like an iron-rich rock?
Very unusual. Obviously, the pattern itself, because it is a duplication of that crop circle, was intriguing. It's not very easily worked material. There are hundreds of other natural materials that would be more easily worked than this material.
And in your professional career, have you ever seen an iron-rich rock similar to this one in which anybody had done any carving the way this is three-dimensionally growing out of the surface of the rock?
No, I haven't. The rock is remarkable in the presence of this pattern. There was no difference in the body of the rock itself and the carving. All one piece. It doesn't look like it was stamped. That area of the carving was completely consistent with the rest of the rock. And there was really no evidence of how this was made.
You know, George, in my three-part Earth Files about this research with the rock and going back to the August 2nd, 1996 crop formation, it is a absolute match of the pattern, circle and a crescent, a circle and a crescent, each inside of circles with these splaying sort of like arcs or plumes mm-hmm. coming out. But here is a very interesting observation. The Lidington Castle in 1996 on August 2nd, the circle and the crescent are made by standing crop, and then the plants were swirled down around the crescent and the circle so that you can see, like bas-relief, you can see the circle and the crescent. In the rock, think of this very satin-smooth, hard, iron-rich rock that has magnetite in it, and then rising up from the surface of the rock by about an eighth of an inch is this same crop pattern, except in the rock, it rises up, and I took really wonderful, I hope, photos for everybody to see so you can see an actual real color of this rich chocolate at Earth Files while I was down there in the lab. the rock itself, the circle and the crescent, are made by being scooped out, if you want to put it that way, from the raised section of the rock. So it would be like that the rock has the pattern made in such a way that if you could put it down over 120 feet of wheat in England, you would then be sort of making a mold pattern, i.e. the rock is the depressed pattern, and the crop circle back in 1996 is the raised pattern. The crescent in the wheat in England, it's standing wheat. The crescent in the circles in the rock are made by depression. And that is the difference. That if you say, is there a difference? Otherwise, it's identically the same pattern. And it was very interesting to watch Robert Ridge take his auto magnet and put it on one of the circle and crescents, one end of the rock, and the rock would clearly turn one direction. And then he would move it to the other, which I videotaped and is at Earth Files. It's very interesting. Well, it is possible that just the magnetite distribution in the rock itself, which we don't know, we would have to do X-ray analysis of this rock. Robert Ridge does not want to part with this rock, does not want any invasive technique. So I'm now discussing with him the possibility that at least another interesting non-invasive test that we could do would be to work with somebody who is a geophysicist who could experiment with this rock in magnetic fields and under different kinds of magnets. Did you see how sensitive are these spots on the rock, the crescent circles, to actually turning and rotating clockwise or counterclockwise to somebody who isn't Robert Ridge holding his auto magnet? Can this be observed independently by somebody who studies magnetic fields? He's very interested in doing that. And so if we can get that research done, I will report it to you in a future coast, because there is something extraordinary about this rock.
And you don't think it's some kind of Roswell novelty that somebody just threw out there?
Well, he doesn't. And you come back to what the professor said about this being a very difficult rock to work in. And I know that some people have sent me some of their own sandblasting examples and various other kinds of things that people have been trying to do to say, well, this is what I was able to do. But Professor Constantopoulos even brought in a colleague to look at it under the microscope, because they were truly puzzled about how this formation had been made on this hard, iron-rich rock, and they could not find the evidence that they usually would find if they were looking at something that had been handled mechanically.
Up next, we're going to have conversations with Linda Moulton Howe next hour, so get ready to make your phone call to us. We'll give you the numbers in just a moment. I'm George Norrie, and this is Coast to Coast AM.